Hi, this is Christine Brown, Social Science Team Lead in the Human Dimensions branch of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Natural Resource Program Center located in Fort Collins, Colorado. I'm here today with Dr. Meredith Gore. Meredith is a conservation social scientist whose interdisciplinary research is focused on using principles of risk to explore relationships between human behavior and the environment. Her work focuses on community-based natural resources conservation, environmental crime, and science diplomacy. She is currently an associate professor in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Michigan State University. Well, hi, Meredith.
Hi, Christy. It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Thanks for joining us today on this Human Dimensions podcast. We're going to be talking about wildlife crime today. This is part of a series. We've just completed recording our broadcast on wildlife crime and integrating social science into efforts to combat wildlife crime. So today, Meredith and I will talk more specifically about how social science is integrated into this current and growing conservation challenge. So to start off, let's just kind of define what we're talking about when we say wildlife crime.
Sure. So there are various terms that are often used to describe wildlife crime, but really at their foundation, what we're talking about is rule breaking. So non-compliance with laws and regulations that are really trying to support the long-term survival of plant and animal species. And so a lot of the times you have laws and regulations which are dictating legal use of these species, but when these rules are violated, there can be all these cascading negative effects on the environment and people, and that's really what brings us here together today, right? That's kind of the big concern today.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we're promoting the increased integration of social science and efforts to combat wildlife crime. Why is that important?
I think that's a really good question. I think a scientific understanding about human behavior, why and how people support or oppose policies surrounding wildlife crime, how human behaviors create, support, reduce, you know, wildlife crime problems, distinguishing legal versus illegal behavior, you know, the human behavioral aspect is central to wildlife crime. And so if we don't have a scientific understanding of it, we're not really pulling all the tools out of our toolbox that we can to try to resolve the risks associated with wildlife crime.
Can you give some specific real-world examples of the kind of data that social science has provided on wildlife crime and how that's been applied to develop interventions?
Sure. I think that there's a range of data, right? So there are maybe disciplines that are more traditional, sort of, you know, environmental economics or you know, economics, education, and then maybe more novel types of disciplines like ethoethnography or conservation criminology. But, you know, you can qualify human attitudes, people's attitudes supporting or opposing certain wildlife crime policies. You can measure illicit behavior, noncompliance. You can also unpack the why, motivations that underlie human behavior, and then kind of test scenarios, you know, how different regulations may impact or regulatory changes may impact human behavior. So the data can be qualitative, it can be quantitative, it can be very applied, it could be theoretical. And so I think that it's a strength that social science is so diverse, because we really can tap into so many different aspects of the problem set.
Okay, thanks. So I get asked the question a lot as a conservation social scientist, what are some examples of how social science has affected outcomes? You know, we talk about social science informing outcomes, providing just that other additional piece of information to contribute to more conservation successes. What are your thoughts on the differences that social science can make or has been making in moving the needle in combating wildlife crime? And just in general, what are your thoughts on the evidence of that or even the need for that?
I think that conservation social science can be integrated with, you know, ecological information, biological information, political information, and really help improve the efficacy of decisions. And so there may be in the state of Michigan, for example, we have a number of fur bear species that can be legally trapped. So otter, fisher, bobcat, and marten, for example, these are limited take species. And some of these animals are, they have very specific reproductive traits and, you know, very specific ecological and biological requirements. And so the state does population modeling, but they also know that there can be illegal take of these species. And so I've been fortunate enough to collaborate with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources to try to get a better understanding of what's happening on the social side. So what's motivating people to illegally take these species that actually can be legally hunted? And then what might make them comply with, or what would underlie compliance with rules if they were, you know, what could we predict compliance? Could we predict behavior down the line? The idea is that if we collect data that is formatted in a way that's compatible with the biological information, then the state would have a more complete picture of what's going on. And then that would result in more effective management of these species. It would result in stakeholders who are feeling like the agency is being more responsive to some of their needs, because in this case, it was the trappers that actually brought the issue to the agency. You know, and I think it can result in more effective and enduring decision making.
Great. Yeah. And I think that's just kind of the general sort of rationale for social science across the board when it comes to integrating it into conservation decision making. So we feel, we know that we can really provide a lot of important information in combating wildlife crime. So we're talking about illegal behavior or noncompliance, as you stated. Given that this is illicit behavior, are there any implications or special considerations when we're talking about methodology? Like, which social science methods do we use when we're trying to study this phenomena?
Right. So an ideal situation is that you have conservation social science that is combined with other scientific understanding for more effective decision making. So you need your social science to be rigorous. And so we have epistemological and ontological insight about measures of validity and reliability. And so a lot of the times, all of the time, it's important to have somebody that is trained in conservation social science, right? We have standard measures of validity and reliability. We should be using them. We have the ability to conduct rigorous scientific research and produce rigorous scientific information. And so I think that that's a huge component of it. And so, yeah, I guess I would definitely emphasize the scientific rigor or side of things in response to your question. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. And another question that comes to mind as you were saying that is, maybe for those that might be a little unfamiliar with some of the methods that are available in our social science toolbox, maybe you could speak to a few of those that you're familiar with, that you use regularly, and maybe kind of touch on the, you know, we have quantitative methods, we have qualitative methods, some people use mixed methods that's integrating the qualitative and the quantitative. How do you feel about all of that in the realm of combating wildlife crime and understanding it?
I really appreciate that question. I think that wildlife crime is hugely complicated. It touches different geographies. It's public lands, it's private lands, it's urban ecosystems, it's rural ecosystems, it's public, it's private. If there was a simple answer and a single discipline could have dealt with this, we have amazingly smart scientists out there. I kind of feel like they would have figured this out already. So mm-hmm. I personally am a big advocate of mixed methods. And so I think that it can be important to quantify rates of noncompliance, rates of compliance, you know, and having numbers and looking at changes in those numbers over time can produce trend information, and that can be really useful for decision makers. But I think also qualifying some of this information and really describing what underlies kind of the motivations of people and why they behave the way that they do, I think that's really important. You know, we have a silent victim problem, right? I mean, plants don't speak, mm-hmm. You know, and when wildlife is dead, it's dead, right? And so that's different than other crime rates, right? So if I'm a victim, if somebody steals my cell phone, right, I report it to the police, right? So I'm not a silent victim in that case. And so the question then is, how do you reliably measure a phenomenon when you have silent victims, or you can't measure how do you measure a counterfactual? There are specialized social science techniques out there. And so, you know, there are scholars out there that are doing really quantitative assessments. So, You know, they may go in and try to use, you know, some more sophisticated modeling techniques and that would require really large random samples, the randomized response technique. There's a lot of game theoretic approaches that are sometimes being used to predict human behavior. I've been using a lot of participatory risk mapping. I think it's a way to get really quantitative geospatial information that can then be overlaid with perceptions. So mm-hmm. where do different groups of people think that wildlife crime is occurring? And that's actually been a really useful way to get local perceptions kind of down on paper or down on a map. I think that one of the really important phenomenon associated with wildlife crime is just the vulnerable humans that mm-hmm. are associated with this. Individuals that are being exploited by higher level criminals. You know, there's gender dimensions of wildlife trafficking, there's socioeconomic and other environmental injustices. And so I found that participatory risk mapping can be a real equalizer and kind of merging multiple forms of information in a way that produces a holistic picture.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, in my experience in doing research on illegal take of wolves in Wisconsin, using a mixed methods approach gave me that some of that quantitative understanding, but the qualitative piece really provided a more nuanced understanding of the people side and those motivations that you've mentioned and all the different reasons that I think there were a lot of assumptions out there about why people might kill wolves illegally. But when you get to talk and have use these more qualitative methods and take a deeper dive and have more depth than the breadth that's often provided by quantitative methods. So.
And I think your example is really, it's really important because you have different types of stakeholders that are using that information in
right.
different ways,
mm-hmm.
right? So you may have a state wildlife agency, you may have the media, you may have a conservation organization, you may have an animal rights organization, and they all kind of use different forms of the data in different ways for their own different objectives and missions. And so mixed methods produces data and insight that can reach and touch kind of all those different stakeholders. So all those different stakeholders can see themselves, they can use that data. And, mm-hmm. you know, this is a complicated and sticky and I would argue really important issue. And so we have so many people that are motivated to try to help move the needle on this. And so if we can engage the broadest community possible, I think that's what's ultimately gonna help resolve this problem. Maybe I'm naive. I'm cautiously optimistic. How about that?
No, I like that, and I'm in full agreement. I am a huge proponent of mixed methods research, and there's also the element of triangulation.
Yes.
When you have these, especially around illicit behavior or sensitive topics, where there's maybe some uncertainty around one source, and where when you have data coming from other approaches, that it can confirm your conclusions a little bit more.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So people will say, like, why? I can't believe that people tell you information about this. And it's like, yeah, well, I just asked them, you know?
Yes.
I mean, I've gone into places in Madagascar and ask people, you know, where is illegal logging occurring? When does it occur? How does it occur? How are the trees moved? And then can ask different groups. So you can ask forest ecologists who know a little bit of something. And then you can also ask women who are hired by the loggers to bring them food on a daily basis. And I think that we don't do ourselves any favors by assuming that people are not willing to share information. A lot of people are very honored, I have found, to simply be asked their opinion, to be engaged and to think that their opinion and their lived experience might actually be meaningful. I think kind of that should not be underestimated. And I think sometimes it is. So simply asking people, you know, and using mixed methods, triangulating our data, using multiple forms of inquiry, I think actually can really produce some great, great science.
I found the same, and along those lines, I feel like you see that among disenfranchised communities a lot, where
yes.
they feel like they aren't ever asked. They don't have a voice. They don't have any power in a situation. So when someone comes in and starts asking these questions, they often welcome the opportunity.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I just want to say that, you know, when I go out and I do interviews, you know, semi-structured interviews, for example, I always actually think it's a really good thing when people tell me no. So a huge measure of whether or not my science is rigorous is when people refuse to participate, because that means that people, that I'm doing something right as a researcher. People should be able to say no, right? These mm-hmm. are when it's a voluntary interview, when people are saying no, that means that I'm doing something right as a scientist. And people do say no, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And so I think that we have some really sophisticated modeling and statistical procedures that we can use to quantify and qualify some of these issues, but we also have some, I'll just call them kind of good old fashioned, you know, methods of inquiry when integrated in mixed methods ways can be maybe even stronger than some of the snazzy sophisticated mm-hmm. stuff.
So switching gears a little bit, getting a little bit more maybe conceptual. In our field, we often talk about beliefs and attitudes. I mean, probably most of the general audience would be quite familiar with discussions and research on attitudes. How helpful do you feel like those concepts are in the study of wildlife crime? And then are there other things such as motivations? Does that help you get at why people are doing all of the different kinds of behaviors that fall under that broad umbrella of crime? And what are some of those?
So I think when I'll give you my response in terms of what we would, you know, think about serious, you know, the more serious wildlife crime, right? So we're not thinking about, you know, lower level individuals that are kind of poaching for subsistence. You know, you're talking about the higher level, more professional criminals who are using, you know, more organized approaches and stuff like that. And I think that understanding attitudes is really important, right? Because we know from theory of planned behavior and so many other psychological theories out there that attitudes can influence behavior. But we also know that the relationship is tenuous, the relationship can be ephemeral, there's so many confounding factors. And then we also are not doing a good job of testing theories that are essentially developed in the global north and testing them in the global south or around the world. I think, forgive me for offering that, I think we could do better as a field in that regard. But so I think that understanding attitudes matter, for sure. Attitudes influence behavior, for sure. But there are other types of theories out there that I think are really interesting to talk about. So, you know, one of the things that I've been doing is leveraging routine activity theory, right, which is born out of criminology and crime science, which says that a crime occurs when you have the overlap in space and time of a motivated offender, a suitable target, and a lack of guardianship. And so then the idea is that you as an interventionist simply need to break that overlap in space and time. So do you want to focus on the suitable target? You want to pull all the rhinos out of the wild and put them in a zoo? That could be your intervention. You know, a lack of guardianship. Do you want to try to build capacity of law enforcement officers, you know, put more boots on the ground, do more professionalization, or have local guardians, you know, assist? Or do you want to focus on the motivated offenders? You know, why are people violating rules and engaging in wildlife crime for issues of income generation? Or are there other reasons like, you know, disenfranchisement with, you know, protected area rules or entertainment or boredom or a lack of benefits from conservancies? There's all sorts of different motivations that can be measured, qualified, and then incorporated into this idea of routine activity theory. And routine activity theory has been used in all sorts of different crime contexts. So homicide, domestic violence, burglary, street crime, larceny. And so, and we're also, there's a lot of us that are using it in the wildlife crime space. And so I think is exciting in a way because it offers a way to leverage interdisciplinary, an integrated approach to wildlife crime in both a prescriptive way, sort of a predictive way, but then also responsive. And I think that's what we need a lot in my experience based on, you know, my work on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think when you were talking about all those motivations, that's a really good way for the listener to think about how are the social science understanding of this phenomenon of wildlife crime can help develop more effective interventions. I mean, if you're talking about a motivation that is people feeling disenfranchised, so they're going out and killing wildlife to get a response, or maybe as a result of human-wildlife conflict, they're trying to keep animals out of their crops, or they're trying to put food on the table, or are they trying to make money? All of those things you would likely, in theory, have different approaches.
You would absolutely have different approaches.
Yes. So that really does a great job of illustrating the need, the value of social science information. So, as you know, tech support from social scientists is often requested really late in conservation project cycles. So, in advising on wildlife crime, at what point would you recommend the integration of social science or the inclusion of a social scientist on a project team?
So I think, you know, you and I have had conversations about this before, and I think the listeners will definitely have experiences with this as well. Best practice would be to have a team of individuals and to have a social scientist or multiple social scientists collaborating from the get-go. And so I think the construction of theory, the delineation of objectives, you know, matching the data collection protocols to all the theory and objectives, you know, I think having a social scientist be part of the team through the sort of the life cycle of the project, I think, is essential. But that's not always what happens, right? And that doesn't, a lot of the times people don't have the funding, they don't have the professional contacts, or maybe they're intentionally excluding social science. That does happen. Or maybe they don't realize until the end, that the end or kind of toward the more adult or geriatric part of the project, that, yeah, that they need social science. And I think there are social scientists that can contribute at any place, right? So I hate to see no social science, but I don't know. What do you...
Yeah, I agree with the ideal is, and I think we're kind of moving toward that in the big picture of conservation, is thinking about social science from the beginning. That is the ideal. But bringing it on at some point is critical because, you know, I think, you know, people are the critical part of the conservation equation. So bringing on people that can help with that portion, you know, understanding and developing, applying that understanding to develop interventions. And you don't always probably have to have an actual social scientist, but have some social science capacity.
Absolutely.
Yes, it is indeed the ideal.
So this has happened to me multiple times where, you know, I've been kind of quote unquote called in, you know, toward the later stages of a project to sort of lend a social science, either interpretation or some analytical data analytics or whatever. And so I will engage to the extent that I can. I will ask questions to the extent that I can. I actually look at those as being kind of exciting opportunities. The best ones, though, actually after that project ends, the next time that team starts a project, I've been at the table the first day So
yeah.
I think that if you're brought on at the end, that's just the beginning, you know,
right.
And that's happened again and again and again, I think, across the board.
Right. Well, I think you and I could both go on and on about this all day, but we'll conclude here. And we want to thank the listeners for taking time to listen to this conversation today. And I encourage you to listen to our broadcast on integrating social science into efforts to combat wildlife crime. And that's available on the NCTC website. And also be on the lookout for an upcoming special issue of the Human Dimensions newsletter on wildlife crime. Thank you, Meredith.
Thank you so much for having me, Christy.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Always.